Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 47 of A Year-Long Conversation. Today, we're talking about Brody and Michael Save the World. We have no less than the faith of the free world on our plate. Michael, do you think it's a big enough topic? Do you think we can fill a whole episode with it?
Of course. We can do everything. It's not that
I mean, we are literally going to solve racism. We're going to solve climate crisis. We're going to solve poverty and the economic woes of the United States. We're even going to solve the problem of Trump. I mean, should we go ahead and give ourselves the Nobel Peace Prize now?
I think so. I just want to know why we're doing all this for free.
Because we're true humanitarians and like big podcasts. We've all heard of Big Pharma and Big Oil. We've now heard big podcasts. People like Mark Maron with a fancy garage that they report out of. We would be happy with one of those luxurious plastic trash cans or something. I think we'd be happy with that.
Yeah, that's why Obama won't come on our podcast.
What if we built like a homemade recording studio out of cardboard and it just collapsed or has some scrap metal or whatever? We're like, we can do it, and it just falls in on us. Our listeners are like, we never found out how to solve world hunger or anything. I want to address our listeners because I asked people to send in questions for us to answer, and that didn't work out. But that's okay because I found a few questions anyway. Just so people know, if they want to send in more questions, we can still talk about stuff in 48 and 49 that they give us. We have topics. We're not just trying to fill time, but people who listen to this whole thing, we feel it's right to, if they want to ask you something, they can. While I was joking around about people asking us, you know, questions or whatever, you said, what if people ask us, why have you wasted 50 hours of our lives? As you said, it is free.
It's free, and it's the best 50 hours you'll ever spend.
I know. I was looking at Entertainment Weekly, and they had a top 10 countdown of the best podcast of 2016, and somehow we weren't on there. I guess we just barely missed
what?
The cut, number 11 or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Most of the podcasts were celebrity podcasts.
We haven't sold out to the mainstream yet.
I know. We're so non-mainstream, we don't believe in payment. If somebody tried to give us money, I'd be like, please, God, but they don't ever do it. That's how non-mainstream we are. They already know better. We'll start off with some of the questions from the listeners. So we'll front-load it in that way, and then we'll kind of move into some of the bigger topics that I hope we can solve that are bigger or whatever. So someone asked you, Leo, what's going to happen in 2017? I think they meant for this podcast. This kind of what I think they meant. And just so they know, we're going to do this episode, which is kind of like right at the beginning of the new year. Happy New Year, everyone. But other than that, the last three episodes will be in 2017. The last two will probably be after Trump's inauguration. Oh, God. Whenever people say, what's in store for us, it's in terms of this podcast, episode 50 is the last one, and that'll be after Trump's inauguration, probably a couple weeks into his administration, so we can fully gauge the damage that he's going to do.
I'm sure that'll take a full episode.
When it comes to like what's in store for America, what's Trump's first couple of years going to be like, I have a pretty good answer for this because it's something that I was forced to think about. I think you're going to keep seeing more Twitter games. Like, I think it's going to be Trump blast Lockheed Martin or something like that for a day, and then their stock sinks. Eventually, people may find out that his sons are profiting off of this, which is what I think he's doing. I think he knows if the president gives a speech, he can really affect the markets. And I think he'll tell his sons, you know, he'll call up Uday or Hussein, whichever one, and he'll call them up and be like, I'm not feeling bacon lately. I cut pork out of my diet or whatever. And then they'll know that's the signal that he's about to blast pork. So they'll figure out a way to short sell pork without it being traced back to them. Or then he'll go and say, oh, we're going to ban imported pork from Mexico because it's not safe. And then pork futures will tumble that day. They'll make a bunch of money. They're asking Paul Ryan, they go, what do you think about Trump's tweets when he said that Hillary would have lost if it wasn't for millions of illegals that voted? He goes, I don't care what the president tweets. I do. He's the president. It's not people putting out videos or some shit like that. It's not even Anthony Weiner putting out pictures of his dick. Like, Trump started doing that, his dick would become the most powerful dick in the world. Like, this is the president's dick or whatever. Is this a secret nuclear code that he's going to bomb Russia later in the week? People would be scrutinizing it. So, I mean, his tweets absolutely matter. As we said with Lockheed Martin, he blasted them in one tweet and it sent their shares down. And eventually it's going to be traced back that his son are making investments ahead of time knowing that he's about to do this or whatever, and they're manipulating the markets. I don't think he'll be impeached just because it's the Republicans. They would have to do it, and I just don't think they're going to do that. What do you think the odds are that he could actually be impeached by his own party?
See, it's hard to say with Trump because, I mean, he's not very liked by his party. So,
yeah.
I could definitely see somebody like John McCain coming out and calling for an impeachment hearing, or just somebody that isn't a big Trump supporter. How far it's going to go, I don't think it'll go very far.
What Republicans will do is what they always do. Because we've seen this shit where Trump does something crazy, and then somebody like John McCain or Lindsey Graham or Rand Paul They give us Trump's comments are very troubling, or these financial allegations are very troubling, and they look like they're going to leave the charge against him, and then somehow he goes up in the polls on the next week, and they totally back off and drop it. This happened like over and over. All during the primaries, none of these people liked him, and they were all against him, and then the second he bounced back in the polls, John McCain didn't withdraw his endorsement. He always tried to straddle it a little bit. I don't think the odds of Trump getting impeached are that strong. The only thing that would is that Mike Pence is way more liked by the Republicans than Trump is. So I feel like they feel that they could get a better... But everything that people have thought about Trump, oh, the Electoral College, they may deny him and they didn't. There's no way people will elect him and they did. There's no way he can win a state like Michigan. He's wasting his time and he flipped it. This guy's got like 9 lives. It's really hard to picture him actually being impeached, honestly. I think a lot of Republicans would be afraid to do it. I guess it's Warren G. Harding that's like been openly endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan and like white supremacists and alt-right, which are basically just neo-Nazis is what it sounds like. So I think they'd be afraid to do it because a lot of the alt-right or white supremacists, they're very well armed. A lot of them have arsenals. Trump supporters have shown that they don't have any hesitation about going out marching in the streets. They had an armed rally for him the other day. Just said, it's an armed rally for Trump. I was like, that's a great way to make us less afraid of this fucking guy. To have 100 skinheads go out there with assault rifles and have a peaceful rally. What are they protesting? He won. People are so used to him like fighting from behind that like even when he wins, his fans are just like, it's not enough. It's like, Trump wants a new tax bill. Okay, we'll give it to him. Well, you need to be fast enough or something like that. They're so used to like being dismissed or laughed at or whatever that when they actually win, they still fucking put up. But there's so many things he's doing that's dangerous. But for the next 4 years, you're going to see this paranoid persecution complex mentality of like, oh, there's a war on Christmas. Bill O'Reilly, Democrats want to tear down the white establishment. They want to break up white male privilege. There's a paranoia that is seeped into white America that they feel like they're going to lose everything. And yet they just elected Trump. Republicans control 25 states out of 50, and I mean complete control, state senate, state house, governorships, everything. Democrats only have 6 states. California is the only major one. The others are like Rhode Island, Connecticut. I mean, are they really states? No. You know, they're just barely states. Glorified villages, if we're being honest. States like Vermont and Massachusetts and Maryland have a Republican governor. Democrats are really, really, really out of power right now. You know, we're talking about it. They've not been this out of power since Hoover was president. So this is their lowest point in about 90 years. They're way out of power, but you listen to Republicans talk, and they're the ones being persecuted. They're the ones that are the victims. It's the same as Trump. He's a billionaire, and you listen to him talk, and the media's picking on me, and why is everybody so mean, and all this shit. And he's a billionaire who just got elected president. He's got money, power, fame, wealth, everything. And you listen to him, and it's like he's the fucking victim. When he picks on, like, a single mom who works 5 jobs or something like that. I think that this self-pity has seeped into the party in a way that even when they're winning, it's going to feel like they're losing, and it's going to make them more paranoid and more dangerous. But when we ask for predictions of Trump's first term, not hard to see. I think we've seen every Republican in the last 100 years fuck up the economy. I don't think Trump will be any different on that score.
No.
Next question was somebody said, well, who's the one to save the Democrats? They said, who's going to be the one to save the Democrats? And I was like, I don't know, Superman? I don't know. I mean, who do you think? I mean, who's our knight shining armor? I mean, who's going to come in? And knight test could be a woman, could be a man, could be an alien at this point. I mean, that feels like an alien's going to have to take a spaceship. They're like, you guys know you're fucking pissing up, right? Like, this is...
Yeah, I was about to say, don't just say he, because you're going to piss off half of our listeners.
I mean, it could be a woman. I thought it was going to be Hillary, honestly.
Yeah.
So it could very easily, there could be a new Hillary. The most promising politicians elected this cycle were women. Tammy Duckworth was elected to the Senate, and Kamala Harris. Either of these are stars. I joked around that whoever is the nominee in 2020, they got to pick Tammy Duckworth as VP because she's like 2-0 against the Congress's biggest asshole. She beat Joe Walsh, and she beat Mark Kirk, and she can beat Trump because like every time you put her up against a huge asshole, she beats him. Who's going to save us?
No, I really don't know. I wish I did. I know who it's not going to be. I know it's not going to be freaking Bernie Sanders, so...
Well, let's talk about that. So people say, why are you so against Keith Ellison leading the DNC race is heating up because Tom Perez threw his hat in the race? I think this is a really positive development. I really hope Tom Perez is who they pick. He threw his hat in the race, but Keith Ellison had been ahead. Howard Dean said he wasn't going to do it, even though Howard Dean, when he was the head of the DNC, they flipped both houses of Congress and took the presidency.
Right.
while Howard Dean was the head of the DNC. So he didn't do too bad a job, but they said, we want somebody younger. I've heard people say, we need somebody who looks like us, which that means like a minority. And even if you're going to put up two guys like Keith Ellison and Tom Perez that may fit that demographic, Perez is head over heels better. Because Keith Ellison, I lived in Minneapolis. I lived in his district in Minneapolis. If he's the head, it's going to be 2 years of, oh, I didn't really mean that. He's going to say something stupid and then have to walk it back every fucking... He'll be the Democratic version of Trump. And so you'll have Trump be like, I think it's okay to kill people. Well, you want to apologize for that? No. And then, like, nobody fucking, like takes him up. And Keith Ellison will be like, well, yeah, I did grab an intern's kid or whatever, but it's okay, because they'll be like, and they'll have to walk that stuff back. I've heard a lot of rumors in Minneapolis. Somebody I knew said that Keith Ellison has hit on just about every remotely attractive black woman in the city of Minneapolis. So a lot of people are saying that he's picked. There'll be sex scandals. There'll be money scandals. He's got skeletons. Don't pick him. Because right now you've got a party that is desperate to attract the white working class back to the party. You've got people saying, we've lost Pennsylvania, we've lost Michigan, we've lost Wisconsin. Again, we've lost governor's mansions in Massachusetts, Vermont, Maryland, Illinois. We really got to work on getting the rural vote, the suburban vote, the white working class vote. Who are we going to get? The only black Muslim in Congress, and the guy who said Louis Farrakhan wasn't bad and black people should have their own state. I mean, it's literally just the worst guy you could pick. And even behind his inflammatory statements, Keith Ellison, he's really dumb. The dirtiest secret about him is that when you really talk, listen to him talk, and people that know him and have met him, again, I lived in Minneapolis, people that knew him really well, they're like, yeah, he's not a very smart guy. He'll basically just be a figurehead. I mean, the reason that people like Schumer and Elizabeth Warren are supporting him, they don't want like a Hillary versus Bernie fight for the DNC. And that's what they think it'll be. If it's protracted, Keith is one of only two congressmen who supported Bernie in the primaries. And that's why Bernie's all out for Keith Ellison. But that also means Bernie doesn't care about the party. He just wants it easier for when he runs in 2020 and Keith can set up rules that'll be more favorable to him to be the nominee. And that's all he cares about. So he's not really that concerned with how do we make up the ground? How do we take back losses? How do we flip these houses of Congress? If Keith is really the head of the DNC, this could be the first time in 2018 where the out-of-power party doesn't pick up seats.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be Keith Ellison that's going to save us. I don't think it's going to be Bernie Sanders that's going to save us. I don't really think it'll be Obama to save us either, because a lot of people are saying that Obama, they're like, oh, he said he's going to take a more active role in the party. We're getting in arguments about this where people say, you know, what should Obama do in 2017? Like, what should his role be going forward?
I think he should take an active role. I mean, the guy is still young. I mean, he's got plenty of fight left in him, man. And I mean, the guy knows how to rally people. So, I mean, he's great to have on your side. And I think the Democrats would be insane not to use him. But, you know, as far as being somebody that's going to lead the party, I think he's had his 8 years. It's time to kind of work behind the scenes and help somebody else take that mantle up. I think it would just be crazy to say Obama's had his 8 years and he should step aside and be gone.
I guess I'm crazy then. And I was looking at, since Obama's been president, for the last 8 years, Democrats have lost 1,030 seats. This is state Senate, state House, governorship, the Congress, the Senate. Like, over 1,000 prominent Democrats have lost their seats. When he took the party in 2008, he had both houses of Congress. It was way better off than it is now. They're fighting from their lowest point since 1928. And I know people are saying those are because of racists, and those are because of the racist people who don't like Obama and all this stuff. I think for 8 years it was good enough to say that. But I think when you really look at how, this is controversial. A lot of Democrats get really mad, but I was like, when you look at him, he was a great president for America. And he was a lousy president for Democrats, because the Democrats lost so much when he was president. And people said, well, that's not his fault. That's not his fault. He kind of is, though, because he never had an interest in building the party. Like, he wasn't really a partisan guy. He didn't care that much about the party. Congressional Democrats have complained loudly that he didn't know how to schmooze people within Congress. Like, he didn't know. And, like, I look at it with Siegelman. Like, why is he waiting to pardon Don Siegelman? What is he waiting on? And I don't think he's going to do it, honestly. I feel like he's not going to do it, but that's just one token thing where to pardon Don Siegelman would be nothing at this point. Like, it would mean, like, nobody would even care, but he just won't do it because he's just not that guy. Like, he doesn't put the Democrats first. He wasn't that kind of president. Obama's mentality was, I'm going to focus on the presidency. And if I can just be the best president I can be, that'll speak for Democrats, that'll lead to gains, and then we can build it from there. And I think history proved that that really didn't work. Like, he was a great president, but it didn't help other Democrats. And people are saying, you know, the way the DNC has been structured the last 8 years, it's too much, like, from the top down, and that the state party has really languished. People complaining about the campaign, they said Hillary was bad about this too, where like the state parties were begging for more help, more volunteers, more money. Michigan was like begging her to come there, do rallies and things like that. They said this state's not in the bag like you think it is or whatever. And then they said it was just a nightmare because the DNC was way too heavily involved in Washington. Like, they didn't listen to the state parties. That's why I like Tom Perez, because he's talking about, we got to build the state parties back up. This is what Republicans did. When Obama took over in 2008, they started the Tea Party, which I know a lot of people say, well, that's an AstroTurf movement, and it's not like a real grassroots movement, but they did systematically work towards taking over the state houses. And I think that's going to be Democrats' focus. I think they've got to take it back to a state level, and it's kind of ironic that Obama, being a community organizer, at the same time he was president, it became a top-down party, and the grassroots of the party kind of died out. He built a coalition of voters that only cared about him. You had black people voting for the first time ever. You had millennials voting, but they didn't vote for Hillary. You had all these people that were coming to him, but they weren't necessarily like reliable Democratic voters. They didn't vote in the midterms, and they didn't vote for Hillary. We saw Michigan. Hillary got like 60,000 less black votes than Obama did 4 years ago. If she'd have gotten even half that, she would have won the state.
Yeah.
You're seeing people drawn towards Obama, and I think that's why he's got to go away. I really do. Because, and it's not that he's a bad president. That's not what I'm saying. But I think the problem for the last 8 years has been, like, he's Michael Jordan, and the Democrats are the Chicago Bulls, and they've got to figure out, okay, what do you do when Michael Jordan is retired? How do you build your bench back up? Because we're getting killed by the Lakers right now, you know, and then the Lakers have got, like, five really good players. You know, they got Shaq and Kobe, and, you know, and I think the Democrats didn't do a good job of, like, okay, what's the post-Obama future? Obama was talking to David Axelrod, and they said, if you'd been able to run for a third term, do you think you could have beat Trump? And he's like, yeah, I could have beat Trump. And I heard a lot of people say that. They're like, if he could have run, he would have beat Trump. And I was like, yeah, he can't run again. And so you got to start thinking about the future. Like, Obama, you knew this moment was coming because he couldn't be president forever. And I think Democrats, they fell so in love with him that it was hard to imagine, like, okay, what's after that? And that's why, I mean, a lot of, I've seen focus groups where they polled, like, black voters, and they're just like, Hillary, you know, she's not Obama. And I mean, like, the enthusiasm just wasn't there. Millennials are like, whatever. And I think that was why our turnout has just sucked for so long, because it's been, unless his name's on the ballot, the Obama coalition doesn't vote. But the people who hate him always vote.
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from. And, you know, you're absolutely right on all of that. But at the same time, I mean, going forward, I mean, he's not on the ballot. Like you talked about with him being a community organizer, I think he can look back at these 8 years and see where the party's gone and be somebody that could help build the base up. So, yeah. You know, Democrats looked at Bill Clinton in 2008, and he kind of, I don't want to say he helped Obama because, you know, he was up against Hillary at the time, but after Obama won the Democratic nomination, I mean, he came on board, and he was, he really gave Obama's presidency legitimacy.
In 2000, when Bill was leaving, the party was in a better place. They still had more governorships, more Senate seats, more congressional seats, and they had a clear successor in Al Gore, and then eventually Hillary. But it was a different party. I mean, you had guys like Ted Kennedy and all these guys who'd been around for like a long time. And so you had like the older liberal left, but they weren't necessarily in direct competition with the new centrist Democrats, like the third way Democrats, like Clinton and Al Gore and people like that. It was more like a harmonious party because Bill Clinton and Ted Kennedy are pretty different, but they weren't necessarily in conflict. What I'm afraid is now, Democrats are way out of power, as we've talked about, lowest level since 1928, and I'm afraid you're going to have the Bernie Sanders and the Keith Ellisons and those kind of people on one side.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even know if there is another side, you know, because, like, Hillary's out of it, and Tim Kaine, I mean, nobody really likes him, and he's kind of like the opposite side of the Bernie Sanders people. Even a rising star like Martin O'Malley doesn't currently have a job inside the Democratic Party, and you said that somebody had asked you if you think O'Malley could have beat Trump.
I think he had a shot. He reminds me of younger Joe Biden, kind of. He has a way of just talking to people, but at the same time, like, he's not as relatable as Joe is, but he talks to the same issues that Joe talks about. I think Biden's, you know, comes off as more sincere, but I liked O'Malley. I thought he should have got more love than he did, but at the same time, who knows? He could have put up a good fight against Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the theories have been like, well, could Joe Biden have beat Trump? If Obama had been allowed to run a third time, could he have beat Trump? I even had somebody be like, could Bill Clinton have beat Trump? You know, so it kind of looks like the party's in a place where they're like, well, literally anybody but Hillary could have beat this man. One question somebody did ask me, and I wanted to get to this, they said, well, what makes you so confident that Bernie Sanders could not have? Because I heard that a lot. Like the second Hillary lost, you should have nominated Bernie. This is people like you's fault because you didn't nominate Bernie. We told you. Bernie was the future. Why am I confident Bernie couldn't have done any better against Trump? Because the way the primaries played out, Bernie
exactly.
didn't win Florida, Ohio, or Pennsylvania. So he didn't win any of the three that he needed to win one of those to beat Trump. He didn't win any of those. Play devil's advocate. Let's say he did win Michigan. He would have lost Virginia to Trump.
Yeah.
Virginia was pretty close. And Bernie wouldn't have picked Tim Kaine as a running mate. So he would have lost Virginia to Trump. If he won Michigan, it's like a wash. And nothing about him says that he would have won Ohio, Florida, or Pennsylvania. That's why I am confident, because I was like, in the Democratic primary, which is way more favorable to him than a general election, the liberal zealots, they come out in the Democratic primary, and they would have come out in the general, but you have more people come out in general. Every vote that he picks up, like, let's say he did pick up a few more union, he would have probably picked up more angry white males that are in unions or whatever than Hillary did. He probably would have picked more of them up, the anti-NAFTA people, the anti-TPP people, but Hillary's voter turnout among African-American voters and Latino voters and millennial voters, it wasn't what Obama's was, but I'm like, every vote he picks up from millennials and the white working class, he probably loses one of Hillary's votes for black voters and Latino voters. It's hard to imagine that he would have done better with women. Like, I think the shock was that Hillary only got 48% of white women. Well, it's hard to imagine Bernie would have beat that. Like, I don't think he really could have beat that. So I think every vote he picks up is a vote he loses. And the Electoral College math, he may very well have won the popular vote, just like she did. He might have beat Trump in the popular vote. But I think the Electoral College math, it doesn't favor him any more than it did Hillary.
Right, absolutely.
Another question came in. Why did you underestimate Trump so much? I think everybody did. I mean, I've admitted I did a mea culpa in episode 45. I was wrong. I didn't understand his appeal. I think from the minute we're born, we're prisoners of our own perspective. I only see things the way I see them, and it's kind of hard to imagine 62 million people look at Trump and say, that's who I want to be president. I mean, I know that element exists. Like, I know there's racists, and I know that there's neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan morons and get-rich-quick people and people that think Hillary's emails have got some kind of ISIS porn on there or something, like she's getting direct Osama bin Laden sex videos. And I know there's people out there like that, but it's hard to imagine that there's more of them than there are people like me. And it's hard to imagine that. And I think it was easy to underestimate Trump's support. I think every pundit on earth did it, because literally nobody, including Nate Silver, said that he had a shot. Nate Silver, before the election, said Hillary had, what, a 95% chance of winning or something like that. Everybody underestimated him. If people were to say, why were you so slow to pick up on how dangerous he is? Now, going back and listening to, like, some of the first episodes of the podcast, the first 20 or 25 episodes, it's kind of embarrassing that I was so soft on Trump. But I really believed that Hillary could beat him easier than Rubio or John Kerry. It wasn't that I liked Trump. It's not like I sat there and said, oh, the former host of The Apprentice, he'd make a great president. Like, it wasn't that I liked him. Or, I mean, he's always been an asshole. Everybody who knows about Trump knows he's a jerk. It's not like I had some love for Donald Trump. I mean, I knew President Gordon Gekko would not be a good thing, but I thought more Americans would see that. I thought Rubio could fool people easier than Trump could. I thought when Trump did what he did and went off on Twitter about former Miss Universe or whatever, anybody with half a brain would see that and say, oh, well, this is... And I knew Rubio had a bit more discipline and he was a bit slimier. Kasich, I think, would have definitely beat Hillary. So I was just more afraid of these people. Why was I slow to pick up on the danger? I think it's because I underestimated him. I never thought that man could be president. I knew he'd be dangerous if he was president, but I tried to downplay it. Embarrassing to look back on it. I basically gave a worse millennial version of George Wallace a pass for like 25 episodes. I'm a little embarrassed about that. Hindsight's 2020, and if I thought there was any way that America would be like, yeah, this ridiculously haired clown that's got all these sex abuse charges, and I mean, he's been sued like 500 times or something like that. If I thought America could look at a man like this and say, he's your guy, I mean, yeah, I would have been like, okay, maybe I should have pushed Kasich a little bit harder or something. So that's a good question. If I thought Hillary was going to lose anyway, of course I'd rather it be President John Kasich than Trump. And that's not a endorsement for Kasich 2024 or whatever. That's not an endorsement for down the road, because we're definitely going to need a Democrat after this, because after Trump's been in there with a fucking monkey wrench for 4 years, we're definitely going to need a Democrat, and literally anybody. The questions of Trump and what's his first term going to be, I underestimated him, because to me, I look at the last 100 years, Warren G. Harding, terrible president, Hoover, terrible president, Nixon, terrible president, Gerald Ford, terrible president, the Bushes, terrible presidents. It only goes one direction. Republicans fucking suck at this. They're bad at being president. They're terrible at this job. And I guess it's just hard for me to see, why don't they see that? How could Democrats communicate our message more effectively? That's the first big question, is how do we get people to see every time a Republican is in the White House, the economy tanks and their lives get worse? Yeah. How do we draw that parallel for people?
Kind of touched on this too, but we're kind of talking about what happened. Hillary lost the working class white voters, but was it really because she didn't understand them? Maybe. But at the same time, while working class America doesn't understand Republican policies, they don't understand what they're voting for. We have to frame it and break down our message and explain to them. It may take Trump's approach, just being brutally blunt and rude and however, just to get the point across.
Like Republican ideals are dated, but I think Democratic, their style is dated, and we got to change the style.
Yeah, it's like the way that Trump treats women, that's how Republicans treat the economy.
Yeah, and they take what they want, fuck like everybody else. Nobody cares about rape and plunder. And Trump's a corporate raider kind of guy. I mean, it shouldn't have been that hard to be like, he's going to do this to the Treasury Department. It shouldn't have been hard to draw that parallel. People ask, you were running Hillary's campaign. That's the thing, right? Everybody's got woulda, shoulda, coulda. Hindsight's 2020. People still talk about high school football games that our team lost back, you know, like 15 years. If we had just given the ball to the running back, you know, so people obsess about, like, losses. If people are still thinking about high school football games from 20 years ago, they're definitely going to be thinking about what Hillary did wrong. For me, if they said, what's the strategy? What would you have done? I think Democrats put all their eggs in the deplorables basket. Racist, he's a sexist, he's a xenophobe. And I think Trump's fans heard all that, and they go, yeah, but does he have bad qualities? They don't care. If you're telling somebody, like, well, he hates Muslims and Mexicans and black people and women, and be like, well, what are you saying about the guy? The people that you're winning with that strategy, let's be honest, 90% of those people are Democrats anyway. The only people you're really winning with that strategy are, like, pundits. David Frum and Nancy Cup and all the pundit people that don't want to look racist on TV or when they're carrying water for the Republicans. So that's all you're really winning, is, like, the really educated part of the Republican Party, but the non-business part, which almost doesn't exist. The business part is like, well, we don't like Trump's policies, but he's going to give us a huge tax cut, so they go for Trump. And then the 90% of the party that's just your evangelical voters, your working-class voters, they like that stuff about him. So the pundit people, the intellectual class, it let people believe that there was this Republican uprising, this Never Trump movement that probably didn't really exist in real America. So for me, I would have went with the strategy of Trump is the asshole boss that you hate. Like, I would have went right to the heart of that white working class part. I'd have been like, he's the fucking guy that promotes his kids over you. You're more qualified and he hires his daughter. Yeah. And you've been working at that company for 5 years and he gives his son-in-law the promotion. And that's who Trump really is. He's the asshole boss that people hate working for. He's the guy that makes unreasonable demands. If you want, like, a week off because your dad's dying and you gotta go to the hospital, no, you can't have that time off. Ivanka wants a week off to go to Spain? Sure, honey, go ahead. He's that guy. Like, he's the fucking guy that lets the kids take the company and run it to the ground and treat you like garbage, never learns your birthday, you hate working for him. That's what I would have went after, is that everybody in America's got a boss that they hate, especially these white working class guys that are so pissed off and so angry. The Trump voters, they probably work for some guy that they can't stand. And I would have tried to draw more of a psychological parallel between, you know, that guy at Walmart that's your manager and he's just, tie your shoes, put your belt the right way, but all this petty tyrant bullshit, that's Trump. He's a petty tyrant and you're working for him and he's going to be that way for president. And I would have went for that.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's absolutely true. I think they did a terrible job of, well, not who Trump is, but what his message is and what he's going to do to the economy. She had the perfect opportunity and she blew it.
because I defended her more than anybody. I love Hillary in a way that was almost unhealthy. You got to take the Hillary bumper sticker off your car, and I'm like, fuck you, she's great, or whatever, something. I love Hillary. But I always knew she'd be a better president than a candidate. And that's what's so fucked up is when you talk to people, they're like, I don't like this about Hillary and that about Hillary, and I don't like it. And I heard this from liberals. I mean, it was liberals that didn't like her, and they were like, I don't like this about her. And I thought, but do you think she'd be a good president? Yeah, she'd be a good president, but why doesn't she smile when they ask her a question about it? And it was always shit that was so stupid, but it was always, even people who hated Guts conceded she'd be a good president. Like, they conceded that she could do the job. And it really reminded me of Al Gore and Bush when it was like, well, sure, Al Gore would be a way better president, but I just don't like him. And I think it was just there on that I don't like him thing. With Obama, everybody likes Obama except for racists. And so that kind of brings us to our first truly big topic of how do you solve racism? Because I feel like people have got to kind of work around this. If they want to save the planet, they want to save America specifically, America in the short term and then the planet in general. Because I don't think people maybe realize that tribalism and racism, this leads to a lot of bigger problems. Wars, genocide, slavery, even climate crisis. Because what are we fighting about right now? People from Sri Lanka, they want to come to India. India doesn't want them because they're different or whatever. So like, when you're going to start having countries fall into the ocean, you're going to see mass migration. And if people still hate immigrants or whatever, that's going to be bad. I mean, like right now, farmer in Syria, that their crops are dying out, they have to move to the capital city. Shia may not want the Sunni or vice versa.
Yeah.
You're going to see global warming kind of suffer from racism because by us, we like to do something about it, but it's like, oh, well, if the Chinese don't, so there's still that kind of competition, global competition. And I think the Trump people are feeding off that with this, I don't even know what the fuck they're talking about, but when you start revving them up, globalism and multicultural genocide, and they're just, I'm just like, shut up. I mean, really? It's like, really, just shut the fuck up with this crap. How do you solve racism? I really believe, so this is something people haven't been able to solve. I think you solve it through interracial couples. And I don't just mean a black girl's like, oh, I'm into white guys, and she lets the white guy buy her coffee. I don't just mean you go on one date with a guy. I tried it. It wasn't for me. I mean, like, real. Marry somebody. You have kids with somebody. You invest that way to break it down. And people say, well, explain that a little bit or go in depth about that a little bit. It's a really strong value for me because I think, okay, so I think people are selfish. So the problem with, like, black activists and Black Lives Matter and civil rights movements and things like that is that when they say, well, white people, they have to give up their privilege. White people hear that and they're like, why? They're like, things work out pretty well for us. Why should we change anything? They'd be like, there's white privilege in this world. And then you're like, yeah, there is. It's pretty nice. Why should we give that up? Activists kind of look at you, you know, and they're like, well, it's the right thing to do. Now, people are not typically motivated by the right thing to do. In case people have never been an adult on this earth for 5 minutes, people are not typically driven by that. People are selfish. Okay, so I'm married to somebody who's black. I have a son who's 3 years old. He's biracial. In the education episode, I went through the nightmare that is trying to get to private school, a really elite academy. You go in there, the bulletin board's got pictures of all these blonde white kids wearing dashikis. They're like, hey, it's multicultural day. You know, it's kind of a joke, really. And there's like one black kid in the whole school. And even in a place like Los Angeles that doesn't think it exists. And the reason that I think that that hasn't changed more is because interracial couples don't happen more. People keep saying, oh, well, millennials, they're going to say this. Millennials are not that racist. I don't know where they're really getting this from. Because Trump had a lot of millennial voters. A lot of millennial voters have the attitudes of the 60s, 70s, 80s. I think they've been saying that for a long time. Back in the World War II generation, the baby boomers were like, hey, when we get older, there won't be any racism. And then the baby boomers became the Tea Party. It took 40 years, but they became the Tea Party. Gen X is like, when we get older, there's not going to be any racism. They became Ted Cruz and Rubio. But millennials right now, I know for a fact, people are like, well, when millennials get older, there won't be any racism. There's going to be a millennial Donald Trump. Or a millennial George Wallace, or a millennial Ted Cruz. Yeah. Paul Ryan, he had a black girlfriend in college. He's like, oh, I had this black girlfriend in college. I was in love with her. But he still married a blonde girl and had blonde kids and white kids. And that's why he's unsympathetic now to government housing and affirmative action and practices like this or whatever. And the black girl he had in college, she's a Democrat.
Yeah.
You got to look at a guy like Paul Ryan and say, if he'd married that girl, his whole life might be different. Paul Ryan may now be our next Barack Obama in a way. Like, he may be a Democrat, and his whole life may be different. The way I try to describe it to people is, because there's a lot of black women in America that just flat out will not date white guys. I mean, they just not interested. They don't want to. They say it's sexual or attractiveness reasons or whatever. It's philosophical. They don't believe in it. They don't think you should do it. They think it hurts the black community in some way. Some black men, they get a lot of pressure from black men. They white women, they're told that's wrong. You know, Kanye West, he shouldn't be with a Kardashian to sell out. That may be good advice in general, not being with a Kardashian. Like that, like at this point, that might just be good life advice because the Kardashians, I'm like, hell, they're like them. Midas touch in reverse. Kim Kardashian dates Kanye, loses his mind. Lamar Odom dates Chloe, the drug addict. Black China, she just ran off Rob Kardashian's baby. I'm like, this family attracts some fucking drama, right? So that might be good life advice to avoid dating them. But in general, black men get pressured to not date white women. Black women get enormous pressure to not date white guys. But I think this is wrong. The communities have got to blend more. They've got to mix more. And it's not entirely on white Americans to voluntarily give up their privilege. Now, I know a lot of liberals disagree with that. They don't like hearing that. I look at it this way. For my son, okay, if I had married a blonde woman and I had blonde kids or whatever, people are selfish. They are. That's just a fact. So when somebody says, well, we need to do affirmative action because we need to let more black students into this college, immediately your brain can't help but wire that into, but my son could lose a spot or my daughter could lose a spot. You say, we need to hire more people in this workplace because there's not enough diversity. You say, well, that might mean my kids don't get a job here. We need to change the way that this bank loan does their program, be like, oh, well, my kids could lose their house, they could lose their job, they could not get into the right school. You start looking at tearing down white privilege or more diversity as a threat to you, which is how a lot of Trump people view that. They view that as an economic threat to them, a societal threat to them. They don't want to voluntarily lose their money and their power. That's human nature. But when my son's biracial and my wife is black, it's like, oh, she can't get promoted at the place she works. That's bad.
Yeah.
Because her money is my money. Her happiness is my happiness. We share a home together. We don't make payments together. We can't buy groceries together. I'm invested in the fate of whether black people have progress or not in a way that I wouldn't have been before. When my son can't get into the right preschool or the right college, that affects me. So I become way more for affirmative action. When I see the police shootings, I'm like, my son could get shot going to buy groceries. When you see that only black men are on death row, my son could be on death row. So you start thinking about it that way and then tearing down the white establishment or at least allowing diversity in and allowing black people progress, that becomes imperative because it means my son is going to get progress. It's made something abstract really personal, and it's made it like, okay, we got to have this now.
Yeah, absolutely.
To me, that's the best way to solve it.
Yeah, I think it's a great way to solve it. I'm all for it.
And racism typically will lead to wars. There's cultural conflicts. There's Sunni versus Shia. I think you blend it all. I think you blend religion. I think you blend race. I think you blend nationalism. The concept of a war over territory is so dated because now what do we have? We have private companies that go in there that buy the resource rights, the mineral rights. I mean, what the Trump people are fighting against, this global economy and this multicultural economy, it's real and it's here whether we like it or not. There is no real way to fight it. And I'm not even sure that most people want to. If we don't do it, China's going to. What does China do? Do they physically go into Africa and take half the Congo? No. They just go in there and write them a big loan and then take the resource rights. When you're looking at corporations and companies, I mean, war is really becoming a dated concept because private corporations and conglomerates, they're taking the money and the territory that wars used to take by violent force. Now you just do it with pens and lawyers and accountants.
Yeah.
I think you're going to see in the next century, excluding the conflicts from religion and race and global warming, a lot of the territorial disputes that used to happen are going to be solved in a boardroom instead of a war room.
I think so.
People say, how do you save the economy? So let's move on to poverty and the economy. That's a good question, but I think the first thing we have to do is understand that Trump lied to people. When Trump said that immigrants were the biggest threat, he's wrong. It's not immigrants, it's automation. Automation is a way bigger threat to the workforce than immigrants. You said this in Uber. They were trying to roll out silently the self-driving cars. So you had several people in San Francisco order up an Uber driver, and then a self-driving car showed up. They're like, oh, fuck, I'm not getting this Terminator car. They wanted a physical driver.
Yeah.
So it went from taxi drivers making 50K whereabouts a year, 40, 50K a year, depending on what city they're in. Went from a taxi driver making that to a part-time wage slave, your Uber driver. I talk to people who drive Uber. The problem with the gig economy is you never feel like you're leaving work. Like even like when somebody drives for Uber, you know, we go to the movies. They spend 2 hours at a movie, then they're not making that $16 out there driving for Uber or whatever. So they kind of feel like they got to be at work all the time. People have like developed insomnia, being like, oh, if I just get one more hour from 3 to 4 in the morning, I can clean up. So you never develop that feeling of I'm going to leave work. I'm going to go home for the day. like your work's all the time. You never leave it. And if you do anything extra fun, oh, I'll take my son to Chuck E. Cheese. Or I could drive Uber for 2 hours and make $10. I should do that instead, really. That's probably more responsible. You never develop a social life anymore because you're just constantly working all the time. But I think with automation, I went into a back steakhouse. No, unfortunately, we do not have them as a sponsor, which we should. We're like, what if Outback said, we'll sponsor the whole podcast, but I'm only going to give you a $50 gift card. We'll take it. We'll gladly take it. That's the best deal we've heard yet. But I went there and they had a, have you seen this shit where they put like a little, it's like a touch screen kind of thing with a kickstand on the back. It's kind of like an iPad, but it's got a kickstand and you use that to order like your drinks, your appetizers, yeah, your desserts. And the waiter came over. He's like, oh, you got to use this or whatever. And I mean, he's basically putting himself out of the job. But I asked the waiter, I said, this is like a Saturday night. How many waiters did you have before you put in the system? He's like, there was about 12 of us. I said, how many are there now? He's like, well, there's only 4 of us here right now. So now you're seeing restaurants. Like, people used to say, oh, well, you can't automate a waitress. I'm like, well, that sounded like a waiter to Silicon Valley because that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And it was crazy because waiters must have made tips anyway. Waiters and waitresses. Like, Applebee's pays them like $1.50 an hour or something. You know it's bad when Applebee's is like, oh, we can save that $1.50 an hour on these robot kiosks or whatever like that. And then, I mean, you know it's bad when they'd rather go out of pocket to buy these stupid tablets, put those there, probably take 2 years to pay them off. And a typical waiter or waitress, they don't even make minimum wage. They only make tips, barely paying them anything anyway. And it's all done under this efficiency. It's efficiency. It'll make things more efficient. You're going to have self-driving trucks, so you'll have Uber and you'll have truck drivers. Now, 3 million people in America make a wage just driving a truck. UPS drivers, long haul truckers, your 18 wheelers, all these kind of things. 3 million people work just based off of driving things. Amazon's already doing drones to deliver packages, trying to put UPS, FedEx out of business. They're developing like a real truck, like an 18 wheeler that can drive itself. When you have 3 million truck drivers out of work and waitresses and waiters, which is even more than 3 million jobs out of work, and cashiers from self-checkout lines out of work, I mean, this is the real threat that I feel like nobody's talking about. I think when you're talking about automation, you have like 100 people in Silicon Valley or Seattle that are designing an app, like software engineers or electrical engineers, software developers, people like that. They're designing apps or robotics that are replacing 500,000 people. So if 100 people have six-figure jobs, seven-figure jobs, but it puts a million people out of work in the rest of America, this is not a sustainable economic model. And, of course, that's going to fuel more and more income inequality as it happens. We've already seen that happen because even though Bernie's talking about, oh, I can rip up NAFTA and I can bring back the jobs from these bad trade deals, you can't really because some of the factories themselves have already come back from Mexico, but the jobs haven't because stuff's more automated now than it used to be. Is there any real way you can think of to like combat this problem of automation or any way around it?
I don't know of any. It's one of those first world problems that's difficult to solve.
There's no push from this from either party, but you could legislate it a little bit. And I know libertarians and people like that, they would scream at legislation that would hinder progress or efficiency. But if you're dealing with an economy where your entire working class, your factory workers are replaced by robotics and assembly line automation, you're waitresses are replaced by computer screens and you go from having 10 waiters at a restaurant to only one who brings the food out until that eventually gets replaced by like a Roomba that they're trying to bring the food out. And you have like self-driving trucks that are replacing advice with truck drivers are out of a job, your cashiers are out of a job through self-checkout lines. If you're dealing with a workforce where there is no FedEx driver from drones, there is no Walmart cashier from automation, there is no Walmart worker, there is no Applebee's employee, it's not sustainable. I know people like to fool themselves into thinking, well, minimum wage, that's just for teenagers, and all this is going to do is put teenagers out of a job. I think we both know that a lot more than teenagers work these jobs, a lot more than just your young people. When I worked at Applebee's, I was 20 years old. By the time I quit, I was 21, and I was one of the youngest people that worked there. You had to be so old to handle alcoholic beverages. So they didn't even hire people that were teenagers to work there. They did support a family, might have been a single mom with 2 kids or whatever. Now, these people are going to be completely out of work due to automation. We'd have to eventually see if it got bad enough legislation to combat this. There is probably a solution, but it's a legislative one and a government one, and we both know how Silicon Valley feels about government overstep.
Right.
Then when it comes to question of the economy, what's the economy of the future? We're seeing more and more automation, more and more software, more and more virtual reality. How does that change education? What do you do with education? To be honest, I wouldn't be totally against one of Bernie Sanders' programs of free college, but I think it has to be for the right major. And I think people have to have a conversation about that. I mean, I was a liberal arts major. My degree was in mass media communications. Is that a useful degree? No. And I meet a lot of people that have psychology degrees that are never going to be therapists. Sociology degrees that are never going to really use that. I don't mind a free college program for somebody who is going to do like an elite electrical engineering job, something that might be designing a new light rail system from Phoenix to LA. But I don't think that's what the majority of Americans are going to college for anymore. They're not going to get STEM degrees. And I think our thinking has to change. I think there's got to be a trade-off. Liberals get what they want, where there's at least more college subsidies. And so Bernie does get his programs to an extent, but Republicans get what they want, and that if you want a liberal arts degree, you got to pay for it yourself.
Yeah, I agree. Which the thing is, I mean, if you wanted to go get a STEM degree right now, let's be honest, you could probably get your college paid for. They're in such a high demand. You can pretty much get free college anyways. That's what you're wanting to go for. Like, even with education, like, if you want to be a math teacher, science teacher, any STEM teacher, like, they'll pay for your college. And some schools are even giving sign-on bonuses to teachers in STEM subjects, but people just don't want to go that route.
I didn't want to. Somebody could have said, you can have a free ride scholarship for an engineering degree or pay $50,000 for mass media communications. I'd been like, well, I guess I'll go get those loans. I think when they enter college, I think it's more about exploring their passions a lot of times.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that like a lot of high school seniors are really even thinking about, I mean, I'm sure some of them think about careers and growth, and there's always the valedictorian who's sitting there like, oh, these top 10 careers have the most earnings potential, but I just don't know that like a majority of high school students are thinking that way when they go into college.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people in college are thinking that way. I meet people all the time, like, how many years you been going to college? Four. Oh, what's your degree in? I'm still working on that part. I'm going to figure it out. You know, just like, I think, just personally, I don't think anybody should even start college until they know what they want to major in. I think too many people go there and they change their major three and four times. And that's the biggest thing with student debt. The student debt, it's going to exist if you're poor and you have to pay for it out of your pocket, or your parents didn't save, but there weren't any accounts, so there's no subsidies, or you're kind of in that weird space where you don't really, like, Pell Grants don't apply to you.
Yeah.
You make just enough to where Pell Grants can't help you out, but not so much that you can actually afford to go to college with those student debt. So there's those people in that sweet spot. Well, it's really not the sweet, it's the sour spot is what it should be called, the sour spot of education. But the biggest way people run up debt, they go to college too long. It takes six, 7 years to get an undergrad degree that used to take four. They don't know what they want to do. Their college advisors are useless. It was all about, well, you could take 15 hours, but wouldn't it be more fun to take 12? Well, you could go to summer school, but wouldn't it be more fun to... It was all about, like, how can we stretch this shit out as long as possible?
Yeah.
And I don't think they're really there to help you. I took a few online classes, and she said, oh, you shouldn't do that. You're not going to get the real learning experience. But it was a way to graduate a semester early. So I think the way we think about college is going to change in that. A lot of people, like you said, they don't want those STEM degrees, and I include myself in that. And it doesn't help that every time people talk about STEM, a politician like Gavin Newsom or some Democrat will come in and be like, well, let's call it STEAM, and let's include arts in that STEM. And it's like, no. Every fucking time, they're like, oh, well, what about STEM degrees? Let's talk about STEAM. Let's include the arts. I'm like, no, because that's what we don't really need at this point. I mean, we just don't need that at this point. But it's hard to talk people out of their passions. You couldn't have talked me out of it. And I'm not even sure if I could go back and do it now, and seeing how hard, like, what major is, how easy. I'm not even sure I would go back and do it, because honestly, making six figures as a job you just don't like an engineer, you're bored to death, there's all these numbers, you hate math, you don't want to do it or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, every day is going to feel like, well, would it really be so bad to be making minimum wage at an improv class? It's tough to really make that trade-off, but education's the biggest problem that has no clear answer. Most problems that we could talk about, they have really clear answers. Like healthcare, that's simple. Like, we should have a public option. So healthcare is simple.
Yeah.
It's just that people will lose money. Health insurance companies will lose money, and doctors will lose money. When you have the public option, or you have like some either single payer system or public option, there's got to be price caps, which that's why we don't have it, is because doctors couldn't make the salaries they make and pharmaceutical companies couldn't charge what they charge. You can't just have a blank check for government provided. There's got to be price caps. You're going to have like That was always the weird thing about Bernie. A lot of his proposals, they actually weren't big government enough. They were big government in that you can have a college degree and health care on the taxpayer dime, but they weren't big government in that they would come in and say, but you can't charge $20 for one, you know, pill or whatever.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to do price caps, and they didn't want to do salary caps and cost overruns, and they didn't want to have these restrictions. They'll never work because you can't. There's no way to keep the cost down. And so then you do have just this, people complain about Medicare, and it's because it's not big government enough. Something like healthcare is easy, but what is hard is education, because there's no real silver bullet solution. Most of the solutions people propose, like charter schools, they just make the problem worse. I can probably give you solutions for anything, the economy, healthcare, climate crisis, but when it comes to education, that's something I'm a little stumped on, because honestly, I don't know what you could do that wouldn't just probably make the problem worse.
Right. I don't know.
I honestly don't know either, because healthcare, public option.
Yeah.
Climate crisis is simple. Fossil fuels have got to go. Nuclear power, wind, solar, geothermal, they've got to come in bigger than they have.
Yeah.
You could basically make electric cars that the mechanical energy of them in motion could recharge the battery for free. And I think, so when it comes to climate crisis, people go, we know what the problem is. We know what the problem is. How do you sell it to people? Keep in mind that America is the only country on earth that it needs to be sold. In Europe and Japan and places like that, they have a conservative party, but none of them are like, oh, scientists are wrong. Climate crisis is not happening. So America is one of the only countries where you even need to sell this. How do you sell that to people? How do you get them on board with it? I remember when Al Gore made an Inconvenient Truth. In the movie, he's like, well, climate crisis is not just an environmental issue. It's a moral issue. Wrong. Don't sell it that way, because morality is very subjective. Nobody can agree. Well, I might think that gay people should be able to get married, transgender people should use the bathroom, and you could have endless debates on this. That's one thing we found living in Alabama, is that when you start getting somebody who's like a Christian conservative talking about morality, you're just not going to make any progress with them, really. So you sort of have to go towards more of an economic, pragmatic viewpoint. And I think if you played up the economics of it, if you told people, what if you paid nothing for fuel? That $20, $30, $40 a week that you spend on gasoline, what if you didn't pay that anymore? What if your heating bill, that $100 a month or $50, whatever, you know, however big your house is, however much you use it, what if you didn't pay that anymore? And you started to say, what if your airline tickets were discounted because you didn't pay a fuel cost? And you started to sell it to people in that way. I think that makes all the difference. And then you start saying, you can't do this to coal miners because coal miners will lose their job. They're like, well, if you don't, you're going to have fishermen lose their job, park rangers lose their job, hunters lose their job, ranchers lose their job, agriculture, people who go hunting for a living, people who do fur trapping, people who do fishing, people who do park rangers, people who are loggers. I mean, you have to have like a somewhat healthy environment for one-third of America's entire economy. Cut down the entire forest, or a drought burns that forest, all these forest fires that we're having in California. Can the Smoky Mountains, those forest fires, people look at that and they think, oh, that killed people and that was property damage or whatever. You've also got loggers who are going to be out of a job. People whose only job is to go around cutting down those trees. Well, what is there to cut down if a forest fire is taking out the whole forest? I think you got to sell climate crisis as, if we don't do something, a third of America could be out of a job because they don't have the environment they need to work in a job. And the other third could be out of work for automation. You'll see a robot going to work, and then you'll have a logger and a waitress sitting there in a fucking circle jerk or something, being like, hey, what should we do or whatever. I don't know what you're going to do, but you're going to have to find something, because the robot landlord's going to put you out on the street, and the other guy who used to own the apartment building, it burned down from a forest fire. I mean, there ain't going to be nothing left. So I think you have to sell it to people as, climate crisis is in your best economic interest. Look at the Gulf Coast. The BP oil spill happened. You took thousands of people who made decent wages, decent livings on shrimp boats, and they're all out of work from one oil spill, a region of the economy that's completely depressed from one oil spill. And I think if you sold it to people that way, people quit talking about the 500 coal miners that are going to lose their job, and they might start talking about the millions of farmers that might lose theirs if there's a massive enough drought to put people out of work. I think we've, by and large, solved climate crisis. I think it's a matter of explaining it to people a different way. I think you stop racism by interracial couples, and the de facto version of that is you're stopping a lot of genocides, wars, slaveries. I think the economy is going to require more government intervention. not less, if we really want to grow it. It's just got to. This laissez-faire, everything can happen without government interference. I just think those days are over with. I tell you, the Republican pushback of that shit, where they're always like, well, a truly strong economy stands on its own without any government help. They can't point to an example of that, because every other society in the world, Japan, Germany, Israel, Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, China, for God's sakes, every other country that we're competing with, the government takes a more active role in their economy, not a less active role. Honestly, I'm amazed America's been able to keep it together this long.
Well, not just that. That can't even point out to a time in American history where completely hands-off, government hands-off has been beneficial and not caused more harm than good.
Yeah, we keep going back to 1928. When the Democrats were at their lowest point and Hoover had free reign, what did he do with the economy? Nothing. He let it collapse around him, and then the Democrats had to come in and fix everything. What did Reagan do with the economy? Nothing. Bill Clinton had to come in and fix everything. What did George W. Bush do with the economy? Nothing. Obama had to come in and fix everything. Every 10 years, Republicans run the economy in the ground, and then Democrats have to come in and fix everything. They spend almost their whole term fixing the fuck up of a Republican. And it's because of this idea that you can have a modern first world economy with no government really driving it at all. Like the government and the economy are on entirely separate islands. People got to start thinking about it like they work together, right? You got to have an economy. The tax dollars pay for the government in the first place, so the tax dollars have to pay for that. But now fiscal conservatives, they've gotten into this mindset of, I don't want to pay tax.
Yeah.
And so if we go back to JFK, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Today, 38% is too high. I don't want to pay any taxes. You know, that's what we've gone towards. We'll be worth $10 million today than $100 million 100 years ago. Because even though you might have been worth $100 million, you had to take a train everywhere, you could have had polio. People who are rich today, they're better off than anybody who's ever existed in human history, ever.
Yeah.
They can eat sushi and Mexican food in the same fucking meal. If I want to go get a burrito and bring it into a sushi restaurant, nobody's going to stop me. $100 hamburger on Wall Street that's got golden truffle flakes in it. And this is something that anybody can do. You don't have to be a member of a country club. You can just go in if you have $100 and say, this is my burger. You can do anything. Michael, one day when we hit the lottery, I hope we can finally open that B&B in Norway. You and me up there riding a first class airplane ticket to Norway, a couple of champagne glasses in our hand.
Yeah.
But I think that the selfishness that's permeated the culture, people say, how can Democrats do this and this? And part of that's up to the people. And people have to kind of wake up. I think people have to pull their head out of their ass. I don't think it's too much to ask that they vote. The Obama coalition, I mean, he didn't let them down. They let him down. They didn't vote in the midterms. Yeah. They didn't vote for anybody who wasn't him. They didn't follow their local races. People come in and they raise hell about police brutality. And you'll say, okay, who's your state senator? Who's your sheriff? Who's your district attorney? Who's your circuit court judge? They don't know any of it. None of it. And I think Democrats, I mean, as much as we complain on social media or protest or whatever, they've got to start picking up that lost art of voting and getting in the voting booth and being more aware of that. But by and by, I think people have asked too much of their government in recent years, and I think that they haven't thought enough about their country. When you go from, that's not what you can do for yourself, that's what you do for the country. I mean, hell, during World War II, FDR, he somehow convinced the Ford plant to quit making cars and to make battle tanks instead at a loss.
Yeah.
Every industry in America was working at a loss. And now if you ask Sheldon Adelson, do you think you can go from 36% to 37? Hell fucking no, tyranny! I'm not putting up with this socialism. I mean, and a guy like that's fine, going up a half a percentage point in taxes is tyranny. And you listen to people like that, and you just want to say, shut the fuck up. And that's what people have got to start saying loud and proud, and be like, shut the fuck up. Your life is better than mine, and everybody else is in human history. And if you're happy, that's your fucking problem. But there's a lot of people that are not doing so hot in America. You just invested in a software company that put a single mom waitress out of work so that some asshole can go into Applebee's and be like, I'm so drunk. Is this an appetizer or a dessert that I'm pushing the touchscreen on? I don't even know what I'm fucking. You know that touchscreen? It had games on there. You could sit there while you're waiting on your Bloomin' Onion, and you could play a game about zombies. And that costs money, too. So it's basically like, oh, wow, it's all the fun of a casino experience, because they had like plot type games and stuff. It's all the fun of a casino experience while I'm sitting here at a restaurant when I should be talking to like an actual another person, but I'm playing on a computer screen. And the waitress who's out of work like that, she goes outside and's like, you know, maybe it's not such a bad idea if people pay more taxes. And then they're using their drones to spy on people or whatever. And they're like, oh my God, there's an uprising, there's socialism, or whatever. You know, you have people like Trump when people say, you know, maybe it's not such a bad idea if you pay any taxes. Oh, my God, I knew socialism was going to come to America, but I just didn't know it'd be this bad. You know, I mean, people have got to fucking wake up. They got to get real where we're at right now. There is one more question that we got from an audience member. Everybody can see that you two are in love. When are you going to start knocking boots? Michael, why is this your email address on this question? I don't understand. Brody and Michael, what are your New Year's resolutions for 2017? Michael, what's your New Year's resolution?
Well, my New Year's resolution is to survive a Trump president.
You're like, well, I'm thinking about getting some canned goods. What if I ask you that and it shows that you're wearing like full camouflage, you've got 15 assault weapons in the bag, you get all these canned goods and like cases of water, you go, oh, nothing much, you know, just the typical thing or whatever like that. My 2017 resolution is to finish this podcast as strong as possible and then start working on writing again or something. There'll be something else after this, but I want these last three episodes to be as great as the first 47. You can't see us right now, but we're toasting each other's champagne. Michael, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and to all of our listeners.
To all of our listeners, a good night. Join us for episode 48 as we barrel towards the end of both the podcast and possibly civilization. You know, it's not every podcast that could end with the end of the world. You know, it's like now, that would be a finish right there. It's just those episode 50, like the second I posted or whatever. I'm like, ah, Michael, that was satisfying. And we see like a giant rocket up in the air. And I'm like, well, at least we finished, old friend, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But, I mean, you know, that's kind of an exciting countdown. I mean, it would be like if they had podcasts during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, it would be something else. I think it adds. I used to look at Hillary losing and Trump winning. I used to look at that as like, oh, God, that's such a bummer. And it is a bummer. It really fucks up the end of the podcast because it's such an anticlimax. But it almost gives a sense of urgency of like, we could be seeing the worst president since James Buchanan, possibly worse than that. This could be the worst president in American history. We're ending as he's taking office. So it almost lends it an urgency. Not the urgency we wanted, you know, but like, join us for the end, folks. Thanks for listening, everybody.